subset of this angels, demons, and you series that I'm doing about how angels intervene in our everyday lives, and that probably angels intervene in our lives in more ways, and demons impact our lives in more ways than what we might initially perceive or be aware of. That these powerful forces that really are vastly superior to us in and of ourselves, that demons have a plan or are part of a strategy for the destruction of humanity, for the frustration of God's purpose and plan. I mean, that's really what they want to do. They don't like God, so they want to frustrate him, and they try to do that by frustrating, by damaging or harming or killing the things that he loves most, which would be us. And so, to live in this world in denial of those realities means that we play into their hands. We make ourselves their victims much easier when we live in denial of that. Because Paul is clear in Ephesians chapter 6. I mean, normally when you read Ephesians chapter 6, you bypass this sentence that he says here. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. So there isn't anything selective about this. There are the schemes of the devil, and they apply to all of us. Then he goes on to say, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers. So we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. The real battle isn't against people. I mean, people are used by these spiritual forces, but the real power behind the evil of humanity, whenever evil is manifest, the real power behind that, the real motivation, are these dark forces. These dark forces, as they are described here, where he says, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil and in the heavenly places. So we raise our fist against flesh and blood, and when they do evil things, and that's a right and a good thing to do. But behind the flesh and blood that does evil are these spiritual forces. They become pawns. And we can become pawns if we're not careful and if we're not aware of that. It's interesting to me that people in third world countries have a greater sense of evil forces, spiritual forces, than what we do here in the more civilized, the more enlightened, the more advanced part of the world, right? And it allows us to live comfortably and to our peril in denial of these spiritual forces that are very much in play in the world in which we live. So what I've been doing then is taking some different biblical texts and demonstrating that to you so that, you know, we can be more aware of how the enemy manifested himself at other times in other parts of the world, and then biblically speaking, what the response was and how God worked through all of that. So this is part two of Balaam and his donkey. I also want to say, it is interesting to me how we oftentimes take some of those stories in the Old Testament and what we remember about them is more like the children's Sunday school version of that. So when I say to you, Balaam and his donkey, you probably remember those cute little cartoons that was in some kind of Sunday school curriculum where you have this sweet looking donkey and Balaam and maybe raising a stick towards him, and then this, you know, usually a kind of an insipid presentation of some angel standing there not an angel as you as he really exists, this glorified, like, powerful, intimidating person, but, you know, somebody dressed in white clothes. And but Balaam and his donkey and the angel of the Lord is what was so compelling of an anecdote of a story in the Old Testament that it appears many times later throughout Scripture as, don't be this guy. Don't be Balaam. So there were some examples. So further on down the road into the future, other people came along and they took the story of Balaam as a warning to people that we can't be like him. So certainly one of the things that you would draw from the person of Balaam, and we'll get into this in a little bit more, is that Balaam was a spiritual person. And he took his version of spirituality very, very seriously. And he made a fairly good living off of it. And that he, in his spirituality, made him a person of significant notoriety, famous in his day and time. And we do the same. So we have, like, kind of in today's world where give too much respect to the Oprah Winfrey kind of spirituality. If any of you remember who Oprah Winfrey is, she will say when she's doing, like, I've heard her say this numerous times, her favorite song is Amazing Grace. Well, I'm glad that's her favorite song, and I really do hope it speaks to her more than maybe what I think it does. But we give to a person like that some sense of credit for being spiritual. It's not enough to be spiritual. It's not even enough to believe in God. James is very clear about this. Even the demons believe in God and fear him. So the belief in God is not the criteria for which we give credit to anybody or comfort to anybody. I mean, it's a step in the right direction in terms of not believing in anything, I think, maybe. So Balaam was this kind of a guy where he had a lot of spirituality. And there's even this one time when these emissaries come, the second time the emissaries come, and they want Balaam to go and curse Israel, and he goes to sleep that night, and God speaks to him and says, no, I don't want you to do that. And so when Balaam gets up in the morning, he speaks to the emissaries again. He says, my Lord and my God. So Balaam acknowledged that Yahweh was this in some fashion, but he did the same probably to every other God personage that was around. That's just what you did. It didn't mean that Balaam was exclusive. Israel was exclusive. Balaam was syncretistic. He believed in many gods. And whatever God he could leverage to make a living off of, that's what he would do. That's part of what made him famous. So just because somebody can say those words doesn't mean that's what they are. And so I think it serves, I'm going back to this cutesified story that we get as children about the story of Balaam and his donkey, that the repercussions and the principles and all of those things associated with the story were actually much larger than what we can recall from when we first heard the story in fourth or fifth grade or third grade when we first heard the story about Balaam and the donkey. And it's not just me saying that. It's other biblical authors saying the same thing. Don't be like Balaam. So if you have your Bibles, and I'm going to go ahead and read this, Numbers 22, chapter 22, verses 22 through 34. So I'm just going to go ahead and read it and give us a biblical context, although the context is actually much bigger than this, but this will give us a sense of where we are. So this, beginning with verse 22, this is after Balaam has refused the emissaries the first time. He refused them a second time to go and curse Israel, but then God appears to him or speaks to him in a dream, and it says in verse 20, and God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men have come to call you, rise, go with them, but only do what I tell you. So Balaam rose in the morning and saddled his donkey and went with the princes, the emissaries of Moab. But God's anger was kindled because he went. And you think, well, God told him to go. Why is he now angry at him? Well, he's angry because, and I'm reading between the lines here, but I think this is a fair reading between the lines, because Balaam began to rationalize about how he could turn this into something that was beneficial for himself. Like, so for example, if a bunch of people who were well-heeled, who clearly were wealthy and well-connected, showed up and said, hey, I want you to go and do this thing, and if you do, you're going to make a lot of money. And you say, well, okay, let me think about it. So you think about it, and God says, I don't want you to do it. And then they come a second time, even more people, even more well-connected, even more wealthy, and they say they're going to make you very rich. And you sleep on it, and God says, I still don't want you to do it. Well, you're kind of disappointed. You think about everything that you could have done with that money and how much good you could have done with it, right? And how it would benefit you. And after all, you make all these other sacrifices. You really do deserve this money. And you begin to rationalize. So Balaam agreed to go, but in the process of going, he began to rationalize about how he could turn something like this into a profit or a benefit for himself. And so God was angry. I think that's a fair reading in between the lines. But God's anger was kindled because he went, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as his adversary. So apparently Balaam decided that in some way he was going to figure out a way to curse Israel, and God sent the angel of the Lord in his way as his adversary. Now he was riding on the donkey, and his two servants were with him. And the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road with a drawn sword in his hand, which must have been a terrifying sight. I mean, you remember the picture of the angel of the Lord before the Garden of Eden with this blazing sword swirling around. I kind of picture that. And the donkey, so that's the other thing about the story. There's just so much irony here, right? That a dumb donkey could see an angel of the Lord. But Balaam, who was blinded by his grief and his reputation, could not. This is very intentional here in this particular part of the story. And the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road with a drawn sword in his hand. And the donkey turned aside out of the road and went into the field. If any of you have ever ridden a horse, you know this. So, for example, when my wife and I were riding horses, horses have this intuitive sense, like if you're going to control them, then they'll be controlled. But if they know that you're afraid of them, they'll do whatever they want, which is what, so I was riding a horse, and I love riding, and I understand that about horses, that you kind of have to be in control. My wife just thinks that horses are just these sweet, pretty creatures, and they love you, and they just want you to ride calmly on their back. And so the first thing this horse did was go into the trees and try and wipe her off its back. It just veered off. And she's like, no, Molly, no, Molly, don't do that. You know, like, I grab, I run up behind her, and I grab the reins and pull that head around like this, you know. And I once had a horse named Sunday when I was out at the Dude Ranch. And Sunday was like, wasn't the lead horse. I mean, all horses have a hierarchy in their herd. And so Sunday knew he was second or third. And if another horse would try and get ahead of him, he would either bite and try and kick that horse, or he would try and bite me. He'd reach his head back and try and bite my leg. So the solution was to slap him in the head so he wouldn't do that. And guess what? Once you did it, he wouldn't do it anymore. So they have their own mind. So this donkey had its own mind, and it veered off into the field. And so when it veered off into the field, and the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road and drawn sword in his hand, and the donkey turned out of the road and went into the field, and Balaam struck the donkey to turn her into the road. Then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path between the vineyards with a wall on either side. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she pushed against the wall and pressed Balaam's foot against the wall, which has happened to me, against a corral fence or whatever. Horses will do that. And so he struck her again. Then the angel of the Lord went ahead and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right or to the left. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. And Balaam's anger was kindled, and he struck the donkey with his staff. Then the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey and said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" And Balaam said to the donkey, first of all, I don't know why he wasn't shocked that this donkey was talking to him, you know, like, and by the way, before anyone here says that, you know, a donkey can't talk, if the Lord can create the universe with all of its trillions and trillions of stars and planets and all that kind of stuff, I don't think enabling a donkey to talk is he's going to break a sweat over that, okay? I don't think that's a hard thing for him to do. So in any case, so the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" And Balaam said to the donkey, "Because you made a fool of me." So it was so in addition to Balaam's maybe feet, it was his pride that was wounded here, right? So he didn't ask the deeper questions, which is about to come up. "Because you have made a fool of me, I wish I had a sword in my hand, for then I would kill you." It says it wasn't enough to strike her. He was going to kill the thing that didn't go his way. And the donkey said to Balaam, very rational here, very rational, "Am I not your donkey on which you have ridden all your life long to this day? Is it my habit to treat you this way?" Balaam said, "No." So then what would you conclude? If I don't do these things normally, then why would you treat me the way you treated me? In other words, isn't there a bigger question here? Like, why am I doing these things? Why is it that the thing that you have counted on all this time, that's done very well for you all these years, that's performed, that you've trusted to go 400 miles, why would you do this? And instead, Balaam blames the thing that's not doing what he wants instead of asking the question, why is that thing doing what it's doing? Now, this is probably true of everyone here, that we've had circumstances in our lives where maybe something worked very well for the longest period of time, and then it begins to break down. It's not working like it should, and we're asking the question, why? And so we're blaming it, or people, or something else. that doesn't perform as it's always performed, that's not allowing us to do what we want to do. And instead of asking why we can't do this, we're questioning the thing that we trusted before, but now it's not doing what we want it to do, and so we blame it instead of asking a deeper question about ourselves. Maybe the Lord's hand is in this. Maybe there's something I'm doing here that I shouldn't be doing. Because this is such a radical departure. Why is this person treating me this way? I've always been nice to them, but they're not doing what I want them to do, and so, but maybe it's something we did. It's always important to ask that question, what is my part in this? So in this whole story, there are seven particular points of interest. There's a historical context, there's Balaam himself, there's Balak, who's the king of Moab and Moab itself, there's the donkey, the angel of the Lord, there's a curse, and there is the blessing. So in short form then, the historical context of this story is Balaam's interaction with Israel occurred during the post-Egyptian bondage. They had just left Egypt about 40-some years prior to this, and it was right before Israel invaded the promised land of Canaan. So they were about to cross the River Jordan, and they were about to conquer Jericho. It was just a year or two before that. Initially, Balak, who was the king of Moab, tried to hire Balaam to curse Israel so that Moab might prevail in an upcoming military conflict. So Balak did not believe Israel had a series of astounding victories over other nations, and Balak, who was the king of Moab, which was a sizable nation in that place, did not believe that he could prevail against Israel by himself. And so he wanted to call in the big guns. He wanted to call in somebody that he thought was so powerful that it could stop Israel, this group of people, 500,000 to a million people, that this Balaam would be able to stop them with a curse. So, and I spent some time on this last week, but I just by way of reminding you that for Balak to be aware of Balaam 400 miles away had to mean that Balaam was famous. He was world renowned. He was legendary. Because you're not going to know in that day and in that time, 400, that's from here to New York City. So knowing about a person 400 miles away that has that kind of a reputation, that person did something or does things that makes them that famous. And so Balak was calling in the big guns to stop Israel, and that was Balaam. And that's why he sent so many emissaries, so many princes or whatever, because he required that kind of an entourage to get his attention. So you have Balak, who is the king of Moab, a sizable nation. You have Balaam, who has to be legendary in terms of his ability. And then you have an angel of the Lord, which wasn't your normal garden variety angel, but one of the big guns, Gabriel, Michael, maybe Raphael. And so why was that? I mean, why the big guns? Like, why the confluence of these major figures, these kinds of people, at this point in this time, right before Israel is to enter into the land of Canaan? So this is what Balak, the king of Moab, says to Balaam. He says, "Come now, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. Now, as the story goes, you'll remember that in the end, on two different occasions, instead of cursing Israel, Balaam blesses Israel. And you can just remember these words, for I know whom you have cursed is cursed, and whom you have blessed is blessed. So Balak got the exact opposite. So instead of getting an actual curse, Israel got an actual blessing from this luminary person. This had to be something that became famous for years to come about how God worked on behalf of Israel and sent a clear message to many other nations throughout the region. So who is Balaam and what is his reputation? Balaam is regionally a renowned man in spiritual matters. He lived about 400 miles from Moab. In terms of his vocation, he would have been regarded as a seer, an oracle, a priest, an exorcist, a sorcerer, a soothsayer, and a cultist. That's all the stuff that Balaam would have done. So you probably didn't want your kids playing in his yard next door, right? His reputation was that of being very powerful and effective. He was syncretistic religiously and a pagan. The significance of Balaam in scripture and extra-biblical literature, so not only in the Bible, but in other biblical literature, Balaam is a unique, you will find him in other places in scripture. And I think I have some other examples of that. Balaam has a unique connection with the angel of the Lord. And in terms of Balaam's character, he's greedy. And later on, he dies at the hand of not Moses directly, but Moses' forces. Because what Balaam does is, and this is a while later, Balaam counsels the Midianites to use their women to seduce Israelite men into marriage so that they can undermine Judaism through men and the wives that they marry. That was Balaam's counsel to the Midianites. And so later on in a war, Balaam dies. He's hacked to death with a sword by Moses' forces for doing that. This is how Balaam dies. So who are Balak and Moab? The Moabites were descendants of Lot. So remember Abraham and Lot? Lot was Abraham's nephew, and they kind of divided. And Moab are the descendants of Lot. So they're kind of related to each other way back. Ruth was a Moabitess. Remember the story of Ruth? She was a Moabitess, and she converted to Judaism. The Moabites faded from history after the Babylonians conquered that region about the same time they conquered Israel. Balak was the king of the nation of Moab, and the conundrum and his problem was that he was about to be invaded by Israel and defeated. And so Balaam was an attempted solution to his problem. So let's talk about Balaam's donkey. Donkeys were typical for traveling. There's no overt symbolic association, so you would not in this particular story associate this donkey with the donkey that Jesus rode on, right? I mean, sometimes you can do that, but not here. They were regarded as faithful beasts of burden. This particular donkey could see the angel of the Lord when Balaam could not, and this donkey talked. Well, what about the angel of the Lord? This is not a typical angel. This was the angel of the Lord. It was probably an archangel. And so as an archangel, more closely associated with Yahweh and his authority. Remember that angels were messengers, guides, protectors, and they interceded. And so that's what this angel did in particular, protect, give some guidance, but interceded. Now, here's an interesting thing that you might want to be aware of. Other biblical characters who encounter an angel of the Lord were Hagar. So Hagar was Sarah's handmaiden that she married, had married to Abraham. So, and she had a son named Ishmael, and Ishmael was the father of the Arabs. Later on, Islam. Then there, an angel of the Lord spoke to Abraham. An angel of the Lord spoke to Moses. An angel of the Lord spoke to Joshua and Zechariah, Gideon, Samson's parents, Manoah, that was the father. Angel of the Lord spoke to David. An angel of the Lord came to Elijah and ministered to him after Jezebel's threats. An angel of the Lord spoke to Joseph in the New Testament, to Zechariah, that is John's father. An angel of the Lord was associated with Mary. An angel of the Lord spoke to the shepherds. And an angel of the Lord spoke to Philippian, the Ethiopian, and an angel of the Lord spoke to Peter. So that's when that kind of an angel spoke. And not all, but in almost all cases, when an angel of the Lord appears, there's something really dramatic taking place. And in the Old Testament, it usually has to do with the establishment of Israel as a nation or the vitality or recovery of Israel as a nation. In other words, an angel of the Lord would get involved when, so for example, with Daniel, an angel of the Lord got involved when the exiles were returning to Israel. An angel of the Lord was getting involved with Balaam as Israel was about to enter the land of Canaan or the promised land to establish themselves as a nation through which the Messiah would come. So the angel of the Lord almost in all cases is associated with Israel as a nation, Israel when its vitality need to be restored, and Israel in terms of its messianic purpose. So I conclude from this that when an angel of the Lord is involved, there's some kind of titanic battle taking place in the spiritual realms. And that Satan and his forces did not want Israel to come together as a nation. And even after they came together as a nation and they succumbed and sinned and fell away from the Lord, an angel of the Lord would get involved with Elijah, who served a primary purpose in the restoration of Israel during a time of great disobedience. And an angel of the Lord came and saved Jerusalem from the Assyrians and annihilated 185,000 of the Assyrians. So it seems to me that an angel of the Lord was sent, or an archangel was sent, to get involved because he was powerful enough to make sure that the events that were supposed to happen happened. He was a big gun. You will recall, remember it, an angel appeared to Daniel. And he was not sufficient. He was not, the prince of Persia kept that angel from coming to Daniel for 21 days. But when the angel of the Lord came, he was able to overcome the prince of Persia and allow this angel to come and speak to Daniel and to encourage him. So there must be these titanic, chaotic battles taking place out there where the evil forces are trying to make things happen and things not happen, And angels get involved to make sure they do happen. And on some occasions, the angel of the Lord gets involved, especially when it has to do with something with Israel as a nation, as well as the messianic elements that are associated with that in any way. An angel of the Lord came to Joseph, to Zechariah. Why? Because it had direct messianic implications. And the enemy knew that, and he was the one that was powerful enough to make sure it happened. Some of this is interpretive on my part, but I think a fair interpretation. The enemy does not want the Messiah to prevail. He does not want the work of the Messiah to be successful in our lives. And so there are these wars, these battles that take place in the spiritual realms to keep that from happening. Now, here's what I want to say. Notably, Balaam appears to be the only non-believer or a syncretistic figure, a pagan, in the entire Bible that has a personal encounter and conversation with an angel of the Lord. As I looked through the scriptures, I couldn't find any other pagan, non-believer, who actually had a conversation with an angel of the Lord. I think there's some significance there. And I think that part of the significance is that Israel was about to establish itself as a nation through which the Messiah would come, and an angel of the Lord did not want a curse to be cast over Israel in that way. And you think, well, it's just a curse. What's the big, fat, hairy deal over that? Why should that matter? Well, it matters because the Jews, as well as all people in ancient Palestine, believed that all words had an innate meaning and as such possessed extrinsic and almost magical power. If you go on to the next slide for me. The Jews, as well as all people in ancient Palestine, believed that all words had innate meaning and as such possessed extrinsic and almost magical power. A curse in that day and in that time was a big, big thing. And there is the thing that the curse might actually do, and then there's the perception or the fear of the curse itself that might do something. You know, you can be fearful of something, and what you're afraid of may never happen, but the very fear of what you have makes you change your behavior, makes you change your perception. So in modern-day psychology, we have this thing called a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you grew up and your parents told you, let's say God gifted you with amazing abilities, but all you heard while you were growing up was how you were a loser, how you would never accomplish anything, how you would never do anything. Chances are that's exactly how you'll turn out. It will become a self-fulfilling prophecy, even though it's not true. Words have power. And so the Jews believed, so let me just say this, names. The Jews believed that what you named a child, that's what they would be. So, when I named my two children, my wife and I, Jeremiah Sean, the word Jeremiah as a name means God shall establish. Sean is the same as John, which means anointed of God. God shall establish. God shall establish through he who is anointed of God. That's what Jeremiah Sean means. Jordan Matthew, my second son. Jordan means descending. Matthew means gift. Descending gift of God. And in many respects, that's what my two sons have become. Names mean something. Words mean a lot. And so when you bless, when somebody encourages you, that's like a blessing. When somebody wishes you well, you love hearing somebody wishing you well. And you begin to take the power of that wishing well on. So I don't want to embarrass Ada, but one of the things that Ada does at the when she's down there at the soup kitchen that she does, the ladle, her words are intended to be a blessing. You have these people who come in who are down and out, who have a hard time believing anything good about themselves. And so she and her staff utter words of encouragement, blessing, to give them hope, to prevail, to continue on. But if they came in and she said, well, you know why you're here. You're a loser. That's why you're here. I mean, anybody who comes here is a loser. I mean, they can't get it together. She would never say that. Because that would be so destructive. It would be like a curse. Those words would speak so powerfully to those people in that way. So, again, and this is somewhat conjecture, but my sense is that God did not want Balaam to curse Israel because those words could have power. But on the other hand, even the perception of what the curse could do could have power. And so God set out to demonstrate not only to Barak and to Balaam, but to the whole of that region, that his sovereignty and his plan would prevail over all of that. And that Balaam, who was this powerful figure, submitted to the God of Israel. All very powerful. So to bless and to curse among all cultures then was a very big deal, with no small degree of hope and fear. So what are some of the applications of this story of Balaam and his donkey and the angel of the Lord? There are three. There's the theological supremacy and the sovereignty of Yahweh. And there's the implied spiritual warfare that angels are involved. And then there's a spiritual formation component to this as well. So just to remind everybody, biblically speaking, the angel of the Lord only appears when there is something of enormous importance at play to ensure that there is success. Exclusively, the angel of the Lord is involved only when the existence and or the vitality of Israel is an issue, number one. Number two, when there are direct and or non-indirect messianic implications. Number three, note that the existence and or vitality of Israel always has messianic implications, always. Because that's the promise, that the Messiah would come through Israel. So if Israel disappears, there's no Messiah. And number four, the angel of the Lord is God's sovereign intervention to assure that his plan will come to fruition. This was a clash of the titans for all the world to see at the time. The king of Moab, Balaam, a world-renowned prophet or seer. There was a significant demonic temptation that's implied here. We have the angel of the Lord that's involved in terms as a part of the Titan complex. And like Daniel, the involvement of the angel of the Lord and Yahweh is motivated by Israel occupying Canaan. So primary lesson number one. Even after hearing clear direction from God and stating our intention to be obedient to it, our unresolved pride and sin returns to blind us through rationalizations from being able to see him when he is correcting and about to discipline. Understand that when things do not go our way, even if they've always gone that way in the past, in many cases, it really ought to mean a better look inside of ourselves as opposed to a better look of what is happening around us. If something that we've trusted in before is not going our way, like the donkey, then maybe that means we better take a deeper look inside of ourselves, because that thing was always faithful. Now it's not. Why? Is it because of that thing, or is it because of me? Is there something in me? Is my sin blinding me in some way? I think that's a fair analysis of Balaam and his donkey. Primary lesson number two. There's a lot of irony here. Many times we are so invested in our sin because we have habituated it so much. It's become a habit. We've built our life around it, that lesser beings like donkeys can clearly see God while we cannot and won't see God. The donkey saw the angel of the Lord and Balaam did not. And we can't miss the insulting comparison here. Really, it was insulting to Balaam that this donkey, this stupid animal, could actually see an emissary of God, and Balaam could not, even though he had this vaunted reputation for being incredibly spiritual. Does this make sense to everybody? Sometimes we build our life around our sin so much that life around our sin blinds us to being able to see God at work, God guiding, God intervening and trying to get us to go in a different direction than what we were going, or to change the purpose for which we are going in that direction. Primary lesson number three. When circumstances and things don't go our way in an atypical fashion, we blame something other than ourselves. So Balaam blamed the donkey, and we abuse those things. We abuse that person. We abuse that instrument, that car, that tool, whatever it is. We abuse those things rather than taking a look inside of ourselves. It's our sin that interferes with our flourishing and purpose as God has given to us. Unconfessed and unresolved sin blinds us. This is often, not exclusively, why there is suffering in our lives. Balaam suffered because of that. And when we are blind to his will and his commandments, then pain and humiliation can be used to bring about repentance and godliness, to give us sight for the road before us. So if a thing doesn't work like it should, and if there's suffering associated with that particular thing, then at the very least, take a look inside, because it could be the sin that is blinding us.